great pleasure to be able to respond to these three very searching, very far-reaching presentations. And I'm going to suggest four areas that seem to be emerging from discussion so far, which might perhaps feed into a discussion later on. And the first of these is picking up Pope Benedict's observation, as quoted by Susie, about how the atheism of indifference is an obstacle to development. Now, by atheism of indifference, what I'm assuming that Pope means is a lack of belief in God that is also a lack of belief in humanity. I think one of the themes that's coming through is that a lack of belief in humanity is at the root of many of our problems. And even when people proclaim that they have faith in humanity, that doesn't necessarily give them what Sister McGellar called a place to stand, a phrase which I found very, very resonant. Not believing in God or not believing that there is somewhere where we can stand that doesn't depend on us, that seems to lead to a lack of faith in humanity, a lack of faith, therefore, that transformation is possible. Redemptive transformation, picking up Patella's phrase at the very beginning. So I think that's one theme coming through. When we're talking about this curious thing called spiritual capital, and I quite share some of the reservations expressed, what we're talking about is not just a set of religious ideas, but a ground for conviction about humanity in the context of a universe that's charged with meaning. And when we talk about that in terms of theistic faith, or whether, like our Buddhist friends, we talk about it in rather different terms, taking refuge in what does not depend on our ego, the point is the same. Now, moving on from that, the second area that I think emerges is that belief in humanity, in this sense, finding a place to stand that allows us to think about redemptive transformation, that has everything to do with a sense of solidarity, a sense of mutual responsibility. That's come through with enormous clarity, I think, in all presentations. The challenge that the religious person brings to the discourse about development is whether this is really about a sense that I am answerable for the good of my neighbour, that my neighbour is answerable for me. It can be, indeed, really intimidating. Sister McGuller spoke about the vow of taking responsibility for the salvation of all sentient beings, which is, indeed, a somewhat ambitious claim. And yet, of course, that is shot through all our discourses about ethics. All of us who profess religious faith of some kind are, in effect, saying there is one human family, and we share that human condition. And what affects one part of the human family affects every part and affects me. I cannot flourish without you. And whether we express that in the terms we've just heard about mutual responsibility, or in the wonderfully simple and elegant formulation that we've come to be familiar with from Africa, there is no I without a we. The point is the same. Human good is never something that can be parceled up and divided out, so that I can confidently say, I know what's good for me and I'm not interested in what's good for you. And all of that has quite a lot to do with the word which has cropped up once or twice and I'll have to say a bit more about later, and that's the word risk. Living in this way, living with a sense of being answerable, my neighbour's good, living with a sense that we are genuinely in one condition, one situation, can feel quite risky. There is going to be no safe place to stand as long as one of my neighbours is at risk. Their lack, their danger, their insecurity is mine, and there's an end to it. And however much we might want to live in the moral equivalent to the gated community, with all the unstable and difficult people somewhere else, religious faith of whatever kind simply does not allow that. And that can feel a bit insecure, because it is. So, belief in humanity and finding a place to stand, the involvement of that with the sense of solidarity, with my destiny and everybody's destiny being woven together. And then thirdly, moving that on stage to what came through as a common theme once again, what was called intergenerational justice. It gets worse and worse. I'm not just involved with everybody who's now alive, I'm involved with everybody who's going to be alive. And that's, saving the present, even more ambitious than the commitment to sentient beings here and now. It's everyone who's going to be alive. And I think it's one of the most important discoveries of the last couple of decades, really, that justice applies intergenerationally. And it is, of course, the environmental crisis that has really rubbed our noses in that. We've not been able to avoid the question of how we take responsibility for those who will come after us. We've been obliged to think that, too, is a question of justice. It's a strange commitment in a way. It means being committed to people we don't know, whose existence is, in a sense, purely hypothetical, whom we shall never know in the way we know our contemporaries. In other words, it's a huge act of faith, being committed to intergenerational justice. And yet, because we cannot step back from the knowledge that the human race is not just us here and now, but continues, we can't step back from that involvement with posterity in the Islamic term, we are involved, like it or not, in the future of others. And for all sorts of reasons, not least for the Abrahamic faiths, I suspect, a powerful belief in the absolute self-consistency of God through the generations. This is a theme which, for religious people, bites more deeply than it might for some. Once again, it's simply not open to us to say that the future doesn't matter, that future human beings don't matter. And while moral philosophers may argue a lot, and do argue a lot, about what exactly the moral claim is of non-existent future people, we as people of faith know that despite all of those complexities, we are simply aware of posterity as a moral question and cannot escape it. And it's bound up with the simple business of recognising that we are under God, given the extraordinary responsibility of sustaining and transmitting life. If we are transmitters of life, then posterity is not an abstract question for us. It's a real moral issue. All of this, I think, is a way of filling out that very powerful phrase which was quoted from Pope John Paul II about the difference between being more and having more. All of this assumes that economic development can only be understood, literally only be understood, as part of an enrichment of being, an enrichment of the sense of who we are. An enrichment captured beautifully in that phrase, artisan of your own destiny. And again, I recognise the difficulty of talking about development in the way we so often have, as if we had a tidy and simple notion of what it was to grow in some steady, cumulative way towards an ideal state of material prosperity, and that was it. running through all that we've been saying, running through all that we do as people of faith in this context, is that notion of what a Christian would call life in abundance. I've come that they may have life and may have it in all its fullness. And I think that the whole of our development discourse needs to be shot through with that sense of what abundant life is. Not just a life of sufficiency, but a life of abundance. Not in the sense of material abundance, but in the sense of a powerful, rich, solid sense of who I am in communion with my neighbour. That's abundance. That's what I believe we're about here. But fourth and finally, just a thought about some of this terminology. Yes, social capital may very well seem to buy into the language of all the people we most like to challenge here. Capital, well, as we all know, it's the title of a large, famous, and influential book by some German economist or other. And it's a book that's made a very considerable difference to the history of the world. But go back a little bit behind the 19th century. And of course, capital becomes really important for the first time in around 16th or 17th centuries when it's got something to do with what you venture, what you put out there in a risky way in order for new things to happen. Venture capital. Capital is what we adventure. It's the basis for risk. It's the resource that allows us to take risks for an unseen future. And I suspect that if we come at the question of spiritual capital with that in mind, it may sound a little less obnoxious than it might seem at first. Because what we're talking about here is what it is that allows us to take risks, to move us out of our comfort zones, to take risks, and they are risks, for the sake of those unknown future generations, to accept the risk of living in a world where no one of us is safe on our own because others are suffering. And, I suppose above all, to take the risk of believing in humanity because of the immeasurable relationships in which humanity is already placed with the truth that we call God. So if capital is a matter of what allows us to risk, spiritual capital becomes vastly important for feeding the kind of imagination that keeps us going in the task of human development. How very easy it is, especially in a situation of pressure, scarcity, austerity, whatever you might want to call it, are very easy to opt for the low-risk possibilities. What do you think of the low-risk possibilities? In fact, of course, there are no risk-free options these days, and it's important we remember that. But against all the temptations that might encourage us to draw in our vision, to opt for what look like the less costly and the less adventurous options. Against all that, I think to talk about spiritual capital is to say that between us we have enormous resources for taking creative risks. The venture capital of the moral world. I think that's what development is fundamentally about. I think that's what we've been exploring this morning, in ways which I find enormously helpful and stimulating. I hope that's what we shall spend the rest of the day discussing more deeply and perhaps more adventurously as we go on.